Good morning. The record may show that this is the time and the place set in the matter of the annual rules hearing of the South Dakota Supreme Court that due and legal notice was given to the public and members of the bar through publication of these proposals in the State Bar Newsletter. As a point of maybe clarification, the court has reviewed the proposals and we have received written comments and we reviewed those also. So anybody who wishes to speak need not repeat that in interest of time. We also go with the opponents to a proposal first in order to allow the proponents then to focus on solely those arguments and not have to anticipate arguments that may never come up. We would ask anybody who wishes to speak, come to the podium, please identify yourself, because these proceedings are also going over the internet. Proposal number one would amend SDCL 50 and 626B4, proposed by lawyers from the Davenport Evans firm. Are there any opponents to this who wish to speak? Are there any proponents? Very well. Proposal number two, proposed by Unified Judicial System, would amend SDCL 15-26A-13 concerning discretionary appeals. Are there any opponents to this proposal? Are there any proponents of this proposal? Proposal number three would amend SDCL 15-26A-16 proposed by the Supreme Court. Are there any opponents to this proposal? Are there any proponents? Number four would amend SDCL 1612B1.3, proposed by the Supreme Court. Are there any opponents to this proposal? Are there any proponents? Number five would amend the appendix to Chapter 16.2 SDCL. This would specifically amend canon, the judicial canons 3B7, concerning ex parte communications proposed by the Supreme Court. Are there any opponents? If not, are there any proponents? Proposals 6 through 15 are proposed by the University of South Dakota School of Law and deal with externships and internships of law students. I'm going to group these together unless somebody wishes to speak on an individual proposal. Are there any opponents to these? Are there any proponents? Then going to number 16, which would amend SDCL 23A27 4.1, proposed by Mr. Steve Miller. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Okay, number 17, would amend SDCL 19213, proposed by Mr. Thieler and Mr. Teason. Dealing with medical privacy, are there any opponents? Are there any proponents? Number 18, which would repeal SDCL 19213, proposed by Mr. Duncan and Mr. Evans and the South Dakota Insurance Guarantee Association, are there any opponents? Are there any proponents? Quite a bunch today. Oh, we have a gentleman that was opponent. Okay, Mr. Leach, please come forward.
May it please the court, as you know, I'm Jim Leach, and I also know that you have arguments this morning scheduled to start at 10, so I will do my best to get straight to the point and not waste any of your time. You're very familiar, of course, with the history of how this rule came to be.
For point of clarification, are you speaking to both 17 and 18 proposals?
Yes, sir.
All right.
I want to address simply what I see as the most salient issues before the court on these matters. That perhaps need a bit of discussion, even though the issues in general are discussed in the letters. First of all, there are many objections to the existing rule on the grounds that other statutes, laws, or regulations, federal or state, require that certain matters be disclosed under certain situations. The most poignant of these, I think, is when the Department of Insurance, Division of Insurance, says we need, under some circumstances, to be able to see files that include medical records to be sure that insurance companies are doing their job. That's right. They do. And we have attempted to address that comment, that issue, and every other issue raised that says a similar, makes a similar argument in the sentence that is found on page 2 of our letter of January 28th. This rule does not bar any person or entity from complying with any state or federal law or regulation that requires disclosure of information that otherwise would be protected by this rule, close quote. We believe that is a full and complete answer to the Division of Insurance. We believe it speaks to their concern, and we believe it also answers the concerns raised by the various insurance parties here, which have cited various regulations which may or may not, under some circumstances, require redisclosure. So we think that's the solution to that issue.
Explain that again.
Sure.
Resolve it by doing what?
I'm sorry?
Are you suggesting an amendment? Are you suggesting an amendment to the rule to solve the problem?
Yes.
And that's in your letter?
Yes.
Is that Wilson's letter? Or is that...
I'm sorry?
Your letter or?
Yes. It's in the letter of January 28th. It's on the SDPLA station head, R in the sense of South Dakota Trial Lawyers Association. Page 2, right in the middle of the page.
This is the letter Mr. Wilson sent?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Be added?
That would go directly at the end of present rule 10-07.
Mr. Leach, when I looked at that, it looked to me like a good suggestion. But I also wondered if perhaps we should not remove the word claim from the statute because, you know, there's an issue about privileges when it's not litigation in the courts, whether we have jurisdiction or power, you know, to enact privileges that aren't in a court proceeding. And I don't believe you probably will want that, but how would that really hurt to remove that word, you know, if it hasn't gone to the point of a court proceeding? There's lots of stuff that goes back and forth that we don't see or we're not involved with at all. Isn't that a meritorious suggestion?
I don't think it is, and I think there are several answers to that argument. First of all, the vast majority of matters that are heard, claims, never become lawsuits. They can be resolved without going into court simply because everyone knows what the rules are. And if, in fact, there is no privilege for medical records disclosed as part of a claim, then who would disclose such records? I mean, it would create this. You would essentially be saying, if you accepted that argument, that this whole big, giant box of matters that are cited in claims, there is no medical privilege. Only the matters that go into court, is there a medical privilege? And that, I think, is not what the public expects. And it also would force any person who wanted to preserve a medical privilege to go into court, which is not...
That all may be true, but does the South Dakota Supreme Court have jurisdiction to create privileges of any type that may be involved in commerce someplace out there, you know, in the commercial marketplace that has nothing to do with the court proceeding?
Well, I think you do, and I'd like to point out that, of course, the attorney-client privilege, which is a right. matter in commerce constantly, attorneys, businesses, organizations, that exists by rule of this court, Rule 78-2, and I think...
Of course, there we have supervision and responsibility over attorneys, so...
Also, yes. Yeah. but the rulemaking authority under the argument made by the insurance industry strictly limited to matters occurring in front of courts or in judicial proceedings. And so the rule, if Rule 78-2 is so limited, it doesn't apply to me as I stand here or as I walk out of here. I can blab anything I want to anybody about my client's confidences. And so I think there has been a general understanding that privileges exist beyond merely judicial and administrative proceedings. And a specific recognition by the legislature to that effect, I think, is SDCL 19-2-3, which it passed in 2001, and what it says is, in any action or proceeding or quasi-judicial administrative proceeding, if the physical or mental health of any person is in issue, any privilege under 19-13-7, that's your rule, is waived at trial or for the purpose of discovery under Chapter 15-6, etc. However, the waiver of the privilege shall be narrow in scope, comma, closely tailored to the time period or subject matter of the claim. And so the legislature, by enacting that, is recognizing that we have one set of privileges in South Dakota, and we have medical privacy, just as we have privacy for attorney-client communications. And I don't think anyone's really ever thought that doctors could blab about their clients' confidences as long as they weren't in court. And so I think that the big picture is that essentially there is a shared recognition among the legislature, the courts, the lawyers of the state that privileges go beyond merely judicial proceedings, because the vast majority of privileges we have are judicially created.
Well, there's no dispute about that. The privilege goes beyond judicial proceedings. The question is, can we affirmatively create privileges that are not involved in a judicial proceeding? That's the question, I guess.
I understand, and I guess in the bottom line to me is, if privileges don't extend to claims, get ready for a big onslaught of litigation. Because I would say to my clients, look, we can try to settle this as I always have, but your medical records are going to be public. I've got to advise you of that. Or the only alternative we have is to file this case in court right now, and that way, when we disclose information, it'll be private. Which do you prefer?
But you weren't giving that kind of advice before we adopted this rule.
Absolutely.
You were telling them that they had no privilege, whatsoever if they merely filed a claim with an insurance company?
No, just the opposite.
Yeah.
Just the opposite. And that's another point, I think, that everyone, I think, at least I, always believed that privileged documents were privileged, because we have all the cases from this court and elsewhere saying that purpose or the waiver is limited to the purpose of the waiver. So if you disclose in a claim or a lawsuit that the privilege is limited, or the waiver is limited to what you've disclosed it for, and the person receiving it cannot redisclose. This court recognized that in Maynard versus Herrin in 1997. And so we think that the rule we proposed states existing law. And we think that that was the law before the rule. It is the law after the rule. And in fact, when I appeared here in 2009 and 2010, some of your questions were, why is this rule needed at all? Is this a problem? Well, the opposition from the insurance industry today has, I think, conclusively proven why we need this rule, because they have come in and argued that they are free under existing law to make any redisclosure they want of medical records they receive in a claim. And that's kind of shocking to me, but that is, in fact, their position, and that's the clearest demonstration, I think, of the reason for the rule.
Would it be, I too am concerned about this word claim. And I'm wondering if maybe if we added something like claim in anticipation of potential litigation, we would be on more firm ground about what powers we have and don't have. What do you think about that? I realize I'm springing that on you. But.
Claim in anticipation of litigation or...
potential litigation.
Yeah, that language or claim that may lead to litigation. I don't have the exact perfect language in my head. Mr. Wilson is also here today. He may have a thought for you on that subject, but yes, I think that's totally appropriate to insert that kind of concept. Finally, two other points I want to make. First of all, I think that part of the text or subtext of the insurance letters is that this whole issue is just a little too complicated and too complex to be dealt with by a Supreme Court rule. I disagree. It's always possible to hypothesize scenarios in which there could be some issue, but I see the basic issue here is just being extremely simple and clear. When people authorize the release of their medical records for the purpose of a claim, are those medical records subject to redisclosure by the recipient, or are they not? And I think many of the hypothetical examples that you're given to attempt to convince you that this problem is just too complicated to be dealt with by a simple rule are instances of attempting to make the tail wag the dog, because the dog is what's going on there out there all the time in the real world, where attorneys are disclosing these records without necessarily being in a court proceeding, attempting to keep the matter out of court as we're taught to do and as we try to do. And I think it's really quite a simple, straightforward issue. And then the final point I'd like to speak to is the proposal. I think it's number 17. It is number 17. This was the insurance industry alternative to the existing rule. And as I read proposal number 17, it would exactly be a giant step backwards, because the first sentence of it says, that a court may, upon a showing of good cause, direct that the production of a record of a health care provider in the litigation before the court does not waive any privilege which exists with respect to the record, other than for use in the litigation in which it is produced. Well, existing law, Maynard versus Herrin, says that you don't have to show good cause to show that production is limited to the purpose for which it's produced. And the proposal raises the whole question, what might good cause be? And I suppose we could have a whole lot of cases and arguments and appeals on what's good cause to keep a private record private other than for use in the litigation. But that's what it would lead to. So it would be a step backward from existing law. And then the second sentence, the court may, upon a showing of good cause, further direct that any person or entity receiving such a record may not reproduce, distribute, or use it for any purpose other than the litigation for which it is produced. Again, that's a step backwards. It imposes a good cause requirement on something that is existing law right now, namely that the records can't be reproduced, period. Forget about whether someone has to show good cause. So those are my objections and our objections to exhibit number one. That's what I came here to say. I appreciate you listening. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to try to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Leach.
Thank you very much.
Any other opponents to either 17 or 18, because Mr. Leach spoke to both? Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. My name is Mike Wilson. I came from Rapid City this morning. And as I was coming across the prairie, I thought it seems sort of unusual that we would be here today arguing about whether the secrets I share with my doctor and my counselor, the intimate secrets that I share with them, somehow lose their secrecy after the case is over. I understand that the secrets have to be disclosed while the case is going on, but when the case is done, when the need for those secrets is now done, shouldn't the secrecy come back and cover those up again, and so that my communications remain confidential, those secrets that I share for purposes of getting better? And that's when I compare Rule 17 and Rule 18, the distinction that I see is the secret presumptively secret or is the secret presumptively not? 17 says that the secret is no longer a secret once I get creamed by a truck driver. And it's forever not a secret anymore. Rule 18 that you adopted last year, and that ought to be modified perhaps with a little clarification, says that once the need for those secrets is gone, once the due process needed the defendant is gone, those secrets go back in the box. And so that's what I'm here to say is I compliment the court upon adopting the rule last year. I think it needs to be tweaked, as you've suggested, and we'd stand down for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any other opponents of 17 or 18?
Good morning. May it please the court. Steve Siegel from Sioux Falls, and I'm here also in opposition of Proposals 17 and 18. I'm a member of the Board of Governors of the South Dakota Trial Lawyers Association. I'm here on behalf of the board and our clients to oppose the proposals and to show support for Jim and Mike. We think that these proposals are a bad idea, and we ask you to rule that way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Any other opponents? There being none, any proponents of either 17 or 18?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Tim Gebhardt from Sioux Falls. I'm appearing on behalf of the South Dakota Insurance Guarantee Association, and I, too, will be very brief. There's basically three points I want to make. And the main one, I think, goes to Justice Zinner's concern. I think in examining this rule, we need to get back to perhaps first principles. The Constitution and the statutes of this state give the Supreme Court rulemaking authority for practice and procedure and rules governing the administration of the courts. When we get into the question of the term claim, which is not defined in the rule, you have, for example, the South Dakota Insurance Guarantee Association, which steps in when an insurance company goes bankrupt, basically. It gets transferred boxes of claim files. Many of those files, 99%, will never result in any sort of litigation, will never result in any workers' compensation proceeding. They're simply claims being processed. But under the terms of this rule, because they are a claim and we are any person or entity, much like another insurance company may be, We are precluded from redisclosing that information despite the fact that a liquidator or a liquidation court may require us to produce that information in order to substantiate a proof of claim in the liquidation estate. And I think Justice Zinner raises a very valid question as to whether this court, under its rulemaking authority, can adopt a rule that says a private entity cannot comply with other statutory or contractual obligations it may have. As Mr. Leach discussed 19.2.3, the statute, you note it also uses the term proceeding. The use of the word claim in this rule, I think, perhaps takes the rule beyond the authority of the court and causes concern in that regard. I understand Justice Konenkamp's concern about or suggestion about in anticipation of litigation or something similar. When a claim comes in, for example, to the Guarantee Association, and these may be work comp claims, they may be underinsured motorists, they may be liability claims, most of the time there is no idea whether a claim will ever result. As indicated in our submission, of all the claims the Guarantee Association has, there is one in litigation that's a workers' compensation claim that's been processed since FICO Insurance went bankrupt in 2001. During that initial 8-9 years, no one would have had any idea that that case was going to result in litigation. So how are we to judge, or how is anyone to judge, whether a claim is filed in anticipation of litigation? I understand that that's an effort to narrow it, but I think the fact of the matter is that what the court has the right to be concerned with, and perhaps should be concerned with, is what is going on within the court system and its power to regulate and administer that. With respect to the trial lawyer's amendment, maybe I'm slow, but as I read it, it says you can't, the first part says you can't disclose this information, and the second part says you can't disclose it unless it's authorized to be disclosed. I think that points out perhaps the problem here. We haven't heard that there's a problem or that there are or have been any redisclosures that have not been authorized by law, at least in litigation in South Dakota. The fact that we want to add something that says, well, we don't cover things that you're allowed to disclose, seems to be repeating the obvious. If it's protected by the privilege, it can't be disclosed. It's that simple. We shouldn't need a rule to recognize an additional rule to say you can't do what you can't do. And I think that is what the trial lawyer's amendment suggests. And that is part of the reason that the Guarantee Association has urged repeal of the statute, of the rule, simply because it's getting into an area where we haven't seen a problem, haven't had complaints, haven't had litigation or any issues arise.
But this would solve the scenario you just gave us, though, with the guarantee of the bankrupt insurance company.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
That sentence wouldn't solve that?
No, Your Honor, because sometimes we are operating under and in response to court orders of liquidation, and a court order is not included in that. It just says federal or state law or regulation. If we have a court order, even if you take it outside of our situation, what if there is a court order issued to a company to produce records? I mean, arguably that wouldn't be within the...
But any privilege, if a court orders you to disclose it, you're obligated to disclose it. I mean, court...
Not under this proposal.
Well...
Says unless it specifically says federal or state law or regulation, and that was actually my next point. My third point is with the amendment, I don't think, number one, that the rule should remain in force, but if it is and the court is going to consider amending it, I think, number one, the word claim must be removed, otherwise the court may be perhaps overstepping its authority. And number two, if the trial lawyer's amendment is to be considered, court order should certainly be included, because there are situations where the Guarantee Association and other entities are responding not necessarily to a law or regulation, but a specific mandate of a court.
Right. Yeah, Gephardt, I'm trying to, the last sentence in the rule as it is now, that any person or entity receiving such record may not reproduce, distribute it for any purpose other than litigation for which it is produced. And that's the heart of the reason it was passed in the first place, is receiving records of litigation that are then broadly distributed throughout whatever databases that it gets into, and in essence, the privilege is lost. You're urging that that be repealed. So wouldn't those records then be open again?
No.
Well, that was the reason for it, and there were examples of it being done in the insurance industry. That's the reason we passed the rule last year.
I think if you go back to, as Mr. Leach indicated, 1923, the waiver of the privilege is limited to the proceeding in which it is produced. And if you cannot, so therefore, that privilege, the waiver, does not go anywhere beyond that. If there is a waiver of a privilege, say, in a personal injury action or a workers' compensation claim, that waiver does not allow the person receiving the document to go publish it on the Internet for some other purpose. The waiver is for the purposes of the litigation, and that's why I say this is already covered by the rule, or by the existing rules without need for this. Second,
implicitly or explicitly, already covered?
I think it's explicitly.
By which rule?
I don't have it in front of me. Mr. Leach was referring to 19.2.3, which says a waiver is limited to the proceeding in which the material was disclosed. So I think that is a recognition already of the limited nature of the waiver that arises from the physical or mental health being placed at issue in a legal proceeding. There's other questions. I guess, as I say, the Guarantee Association's position is that the rule really is unnecessary and really should not address claims, and at a minimum, we would request the court recognize that, but hopefully also repeal the rule. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Gephardt. Any other proponents of 17 or 18?
Good morning, Your Honors. Naomi Cromwell. I co-signed the proponent for repeal along with Mr. Cheese and Mr. Excuse me for forgetting Jack's last name.
Taylor,
thank you. I'll be very brief, and in fact, what I am here basically to say is we do stand fully in support of the comments just made by Mr. Gephardt. We also ask the question, where is the problem here? Existing court rules, we believe existing rules and laws on privacy adequately cover this. We don't have glaring examples that have been brought forward as to problems that existed prior to the enactment of this rule, and we would submit that a return to that status is the way to go on this.
Well, let me ask you as the counter of that then, have you, and this has been in effect obviously not very long, but since October, I think?
Correct, October 1st.
Is there any problem because we passed?
Well, that's an unknown, Your Honor. In fact,
why should we react to that unknown?
I would submit there is a question whether the existence of this rule is really well known. And the rule does itself create, as it currently is drafted, does create substantial problems in the insurance industry with the examples that were in our submission as to how to comply with the rule as well as comply with rules on disclosure that are already required in insurance laws, both in federal law and in state laws.
Well, 2 years ago we considered this rule. Not one person opposed it. We did not pass it, but nobody opposed it. Last year it came back again. Again, not one person opposed it. Why is the sky falling in this year?
The honest answer is we missed it. And that's all I can say, as I know that the significance of the rule and its impact was overlooked.
Well, again, the purpose of the rule is, as it was explained in the examples that were given to us, was the republication of medical evidence. Sometimes within the insurance industry, either intra-company or between companies, intra or extra, whichever, between companies of information on a claim and used in other claims. Now, is that appropriate? That's what the rule is meant to address. By repealing it, we'd be taking that away.
And Your Honor, I think the answer to your question is what I understand what was provided was one example in a case in Colorado where that happened. And I know that the language from that decision is that that decision was very fact-specific. It's very dependent on the particular facts of that case. Now, if something similar to that were to happen in South Dakota, would our current laws prohibit that? Perhaps, because in that situation, there had been an opportunity for a protective order or confidentiality to be reattached to those records once they had
been created. Why should there have to be a protective order? If it's produced for a litigation, why would that then open the information as a total waiver?
And what I'm referring to, Your Honor, is the initial litigation, initial matter that it came up in. And in the Colorado case that has been discussed, that is where the consent order or the protection order would have been attached to those records.
You mentioned that existing rules cover or protect the matter. Do you happen to have at hand the rules that you would rely on for that proposition?
Some of them have been discussed here today, Your Honor, the 1923 and the scope of it. And as far as regulations that address what an insurer may do with their information, those are within the administrative rules and the statutes that were in our submission. And I can't quote them for you off the top of my head, but those are the ones that...
But 1923 is the primary...
1923 is the privilege.
The privilege rule.
It deals with privileges. But when you move to the arena of what insurers are required to do to maintain...
Right. Yeah, I understand that. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Cremo. Any other proponents for 17 or 18? Mr. Duncan.
May it please the court. My name is Dennis Duncan. I'm here this morning appearing on behalf of Dakota Care, which is a health maintenance organization doing business in the state of South Dakota. And frankly, I appear here today somewhat from the perspective that when I first saw this rule some year and a half, 2 years ago, and tried to blend the implications of this rule into the practice of the health insurance industry, particularly Dakota Care, I looked at it from the perspective that, and quite frankly, advised my clients that it probably did not affect our operations, our day-to-day operations of a health insurance company, because this was focused on the arena of litigation and the privileges that attach to medical records in the litigation process. And in that arena, I also suggested to my client that the term claim would probably have attached to a claim that was now being litigated, an insurance claim that was now being litigated, so that this rule probably, again, did not affect the day-to-day operations of Dakota Care. Upon some further reflection on this, and quite frankly, discussions with other people in the industry, we actually did have to take another look at this. And I think I've tried to point those out in my December 17th submittal to the court, that the day-to-day operations of a health insurance company require a substantial amount of record sharing, medical information sharing to carry out the day-to-day operations of that insurance company. Let me give you a couple of examples. Number one, if a health insurance claim, and they all are supported by some medical records, that health insurance claim goes into the Dakota Care, is adjudicated in their in our claims office for payment or non-payment based on the terms of the contract that that member has with Dakota Care, and then a decision is made on that, what we call a claim in health insurance parlance, a claim, and then a decision is made whether or not to pay that claim or to pay the benefits according to the contract or not pay the benefits. But they're beyond that claim as to whether or not that claim for service should be paid, there is a significant amount of sharing of information, medical information, that is received from a provider in the general course of the operations of that company. Example, number one, there are all kinds of quality assurance studies that are done by Dakota Care and contractors for Dakota Care with respect to different types of service or different levels of service. Examples might be in the transplant area. Ongoing are studies done whether transplants that are received by Dakota Care members, you know, what the success rates are, what the infection rates are, what the cost is versus that same type of conditional transplant that is done at another entity. There is a significant amount of sharing done with between entities in Dakota Care and their contractors to determine whether or not claims, claim information, or which need the, this claim information to conduct those studies. Now, with to put the court, I hope, at ease, that any claims information, any medical information that is shared with any other contractor or any other entity is always the subject of a contract between Dakota Care and that contractor. Every one of those contracts has substantial privilege or has substantial protections for that medical information that is shared among those contractors and Dakota Care under typically the HIPAA regulations that all of the medical entities and health insurance companies now deal with. But there is a significant amount of day-to-day sharing of that information. And my sole focus, I move outside the litigation area, my sole focus is with the term claim. I don't think that claim, that that term claim is well enough defined in this particular rule to now give us, and I realize I'm a latecomer to this argument, but to now give us the reasonable assurance that we may not be covered by this Supreme Court rule, really in our day-to-day operations.
Okay, Mr. Duncan, if you took off the word claim and just left litigation, would that cause a problem for your clients?
It would not cause a client problem for Dakota Care. I can't speak for other health carriers, but we have considered that that particular solution to this problem at length. And it's I'm here representing to the court today that it would not cause us a problem. It's that term claim, because of the common way in that we look at that terminology, that causes us the concerns that we have with respect to this rule.
You know, does the patient though waive that claim, when waive that privilege when they submit a claim? I mean, don't they usually have to sign a form that waives privilege for processing the claim?
Well, they waive it at two points, Justice Center. Typically, a patient, think back of your own experiences in going into a doctor's office recently. I went in a couple weeks ago for a procedure, and I stood there and signed a number of documents that waived my right and my privilege for the use of that medical information in this insurance claims processing process. I mean, they said, the clinic said, you give us the right to share that information with your insurance company and others who are going to adjudicate that claim for payment. So there was at least a limited waiver of that right at that point. If you, and I kind of get a kick out of the term fine print, but if you look at the terms of your health insurance contract that you enter into with the company, there is also language in that contract that suggests that you waive your privilege to the use of healthcare information for the use in the adjudication of that of a claim for services from the company.
Why doesn't that take care of it? Why doesn't that take care of the problem you have with the language on a claim if you have a waiver?
Because this rule says the production of a record of a healthcare company in a claim. And so the argument can be made, I believe, Justice, that if I make a claim to DakotaCare, for example, and they pay that claim, it's end of story. But that I believe legitimately a argument could be further made that yes, you can't then share that with anybody else for quality assurance purposes, for the determination or for studies to determine whether a drug should be kept on a drug formulary or be placed on a drug formulary, or this transplant center has a better outcomes for DakotaCare employees than transplant center B, so we're not going to contract with that company anymore. Or, for example, if we are out shopping, as we do regularly, shopping for our reinsurance, and a reinsurer asks for claims information to review the amount of claims, for example, over $100,000 in any given year, they want claims information before they'll give us a reinsurance rate. So the question is, once that, to us anyway, to DakotaCare anyway, the question is, once that claims information has been submitted and it is paid, can the argument be made then that is no longer, that claim has been paid, that claim is over, so you can't further share that with anyone? And that's our concern. And I guess it centers around the ambiguity of the term claim without other further definition because of the common use of that term claim in our industry.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Any further comments? Okay, there being none, the court is in recess. 10 minutes.